All right. Well, welcome everyone to the Joint Executive and Legislative Committee meeting. My name is Kirby Fye. You're all familiar with me by now. Just a few things to go over before I hand it over to Debbie. A reminder, this meeting is being recorded and it will be posted to the department website within the next day or two. We are holding this meeting electronically per the Open Meetings Act in order to just keep everyone safe during the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm going to go ahead and go through the attendees. Just a reminder, please make sure your computer or phone is muted if you're not speaking, just to prevent any feedback, and state your name when presenting or asking a question is helpful when capturing the minutes. So like I said, Kirby Fye with the department. I know Albert Richardson is on the call. I heard him. Kim Parker, Amber Hampton, Amy Holland, Avis Easley, Ben Harrington, Gail Lodato, Kurt Hipple, Mary Nell Osborne, Nicole Bates, Richard Barber, Ricky Harris, just saw someone, there's Debbie, Debbie Hillen, Samantha Slagle, Zach Blair. And the other caller, is that Dana Savinos?
Am I there?
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Dina.
Thanks, sir.
Also, one more reminder before I hand this over to Debbie. We have 9 proposals to go over this morning, and not that much time in the grand scheme of things.
Hello.
So we will need to stay on track. Hi, Debbie. Can you hear me? Hello.
Debbie, you may be on. Well, I can hear you, but not now. Did you mute yourself again?
You can hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Can hear you.
I can hear you.
Okay. Are you able to take over, Debbie, or are you having some computer glitches? Sure. You might need to join via phone. Good. Debbie? I'm going to see if I can give her a call.
Oh,
hold on.
Can you hear me?
Oh,
now?
You can hear us? Yes.
Can you hear me? Yay. All right. Thanks, Jess.
Just in time, too.
Good morning.
And I see Elliot just joined the call as well.
Okay. My apologies for being tardy to my own meeting. Kirby, you want to do the roll call, or have you already done that and I missed it?
I already did it, but I got your name. I was just giving everyone a reminder that we need to stay on track this morning because we have quite a few proposals to go through, so you can go ahead and get started.
All right. The first one that I have is the legit script monopoly inquiry and investigation. That belongs to who? I'm trying to get
it. It came from Region 2.
I might have known that would come from you, Ben Harrington.
Hey, I can't claim I wrote it. I did not do it. But it brings up a very problematic issue for our service providers in Tennessee. And we may not need to do anything with it. Let me put that on the front burner here. There is now movement from attorney generals across the country to band together to join a lawsuit against LegitScripts and Google, because what LegitScripts was doing was enforcing a pretty significant pay or play scheme to be able to, as a addiction treatment provider or a mental health provider, to do any advertising in their world. And that was, I don't know, kind of extorting fee out of folks on the front end just to be able to have the ability to do it, plus putting Tennessee addiction and mental health providers through an inordinate process to do the application to do it. So I'm not quite sure if there's a need for legislation or study, but certainly a recommendation for the commissioner to ask the attorney general, is this on their radar screen, and what are they going to do to join on with the other lawsuit?
Okay, so is that your recommendation from Region 2, since this is your proposal?
Yes.
Okay. We have a recommendation that this just go forward to the commissioner for her to check with our attorney general to see if this is on their radar and provide any feedback from that. Is that the recommendation?
I support that.
That's the most current.
Okay. All right, Kirby, it requires a motion and a vote, correct?
Among the legislative committee.
I'll motion to send that on to the attorney for the commissioner to see that and pass it on to the attorney general.
Thank you, Elliot. Is there a second?
Mickey Harris, I'll second.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposition? Okay. So done. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
The next one that I have, and I'm trying to make sure I get them in the same order, is the Annual Behavioral Needs Assessment Enhancement Act. And Ben, I think this is Region 2 as well.
Oh, yeah. And I apologize. We have a number that came from Region 2. So the concern is that the current needs assessment process, which is rather robust as it is, also unfortunately leaves each planning council in a predicament to abide by current instructions from the department. We make two mental health recommendations and two substance abuse recommendations. What the problem is, and it's a dilemma that probably each region faces at some point over time, is that they're faced to have to make really tough and awkward choices. Choose between a mental health issue that may be affecting adults, or not advance forward a issue that a children's mental health need, or choose an adult issue that really affects an urban area and do that at the awkward position of not supporting a rural mental health need, or advance an issue at the dilemma of choosing to not advance a need that addresses minorities. And so all this suggests is there might be a timely need to change our practices from two adult or two mental health needs and two substance abuse needs to allow a regional council to increase the number of needs that they actually advance to recommend to the department to no more than six. And if they wanted to add the additional two, then those need to be in the groups that I've mentioned, children's mental health needs, so those aren't left at the wayside, or rural mental health or behavioral health needs, or minority behavioral health needs. And just so you know, Debbie, you know, we've been at this long enough. This is not something that has to go to the legislature. It could be something easily accomplished by policy decision at central office with the planning council's advisory team, Avis and Kurt, and with the consent of the commissioner, of course.
Can I make a request to amend this, Ben, to where we would have still have a minimum number of needs at 2 for each mental health and substance use disorder, just to make sure that we don't overlook one completely in any one year.
Yeah.
Say that one more time, Elliot.
I think that's fine.
So it, instead of it just being 6 overall needs that we would have, and it could be mental health and or substance use disorder related, that we would have to, you need a minimum of 2 of each of those, up to a total of 6 across the categories. Does that make sense?
Okay. That's what I thought you were saying.
You could do 4, you could do 4 and 2 or 3 and 3.
And this is Ricky. I like that, Elliot. And I may suggest one more thing. If we're doing 2 to 6, can we prioritize our top 2? Because what I don't want to do is just leave the department with 6 things and then they have to choose what they think is most important to us. Because I think narrowing it to 2 is difficult. It's always difficult. But at least we got to choose what the top priorities are for our group's discussion purposes. So I hear what you're saying, and the struggle is real. I get it. But I still would like to be able to choose from a group perspective what we think the most important things are, knowing that the department probably won't be able to accomplish all of them in 1 year, but they will try.
Yeah, and I would accept both of those friendly amendments to the proposal.
Okay. All right, let me see if I can repeat back what we've discussed. So this is looking at, it's real difficult for regions to come up with 2 and 2 because there may be others, rural versus urban, especially if your council covers both territories, minorities versus non-minorities. I'll get it out here in a minute. So the recommendation is to increase the number of needs from 2 mental health, 2 substance abuse, up to 6, while 2 is the minimum for 2 for each of those, but also to prioritize those needs as they go to the department. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I'll entertain a motion to accept that, recognizing this is not a legislative issue, but more an internal issue within the department, a policy issue.
I would so move.
Okay.
I'll second that.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Elliot. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed likewise? All right. The next one I have, and make sure it's the same order that Avis has them in here, is the overdose. And Region 2, you're up again.
Yeah, and actually the roots of this were submitted to me back in December by Amy Delinke, who was the co-chair in Region 2 and worked in opioid prevention work for Knox County Health Department. And she's since moved to Michigan to be their opioid abuse coordinator there. The proposal is that there, as she suggested, there needs to be some overdose fatality review established here in Tennessee. And, you know, this is one of those that's an awkward deal. We know health does like infant or fetal infant mortality review. I'm on the Knoxville team for that. You know, so would they be the place, or because substance abuse is under the purview of the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, should a overdose fatality review come under their purview? I don't know. But, you know, the thing is, the folks in that arena have been pretty loud and clear that there needs to be some overdose fatality review created. And that's why that recommendation was passed to us.
Now, just for my two cents, is this more of a legislative, or is this a rule, or is this an internal thing?
Well, Debbie, I'm going to be honest. I think there's probably going to be some bucks attached to it because, you know, to be able to do it, I think the legislature is going to have to be on board and realize there has to be the resources made available to any and all departments to do this. And, you know, that means our wonderful staff at the State Department can't just have it dumped in their lap without the resources to do it. So we would need to, I think, pass it that way.
Other discussions?
This is Elliot. I'm Regent Four. I was just going to say that this issue came up in our committee last year. I had a request. Angie Thompson is the vice chair of Region Four, and she's with Metro Health Department. And I spoke with Trevor Henderson and Dia Cirilla, who was at the time over there as well at the health department. And they requested that we consider a proposal similarly about these fatality review teams for overdose deaths. And we talked extensively about that. We ran out of time, which is why I didn't pursue it. But my main concern is what they had proposed in their draft to me did not have appropriate guardrails on it to protect the privacy of those individuals who have died and their family members, because these involve interviews. You bring people in to the team, you have law enforcement at the table, and there's some unintended consequences that can occur if you're not very, very, very careful in what you do. And the other thing, I mean, again, this was maybe not a concern, more of a want, but, you know, the data was not in any way going to be made available to outside of the fatality review team and the health department, so the public would not benefit from the information in the way that it was originally discussed. This model legislation, and frankly, I've not been able to read through the entire thing, but it appears to be a statewide plan to really coordinate this and set some kind of review system up. When we looked at it for Metro Nashville, the plan was doing some things at the legislative level to allow easier sharing of data, I believe, but it was not about setting up a statewide system. So there may be a way to approach this that's more about, you know, helping local communities do this if they want without creating a state system. But again, if the group wants to do a state system, it sounds good. As long as we put the guardrails on it, the right guardrails, this can be helpful.
Other comments?
So I will jump in, Debbie. This is Zach at the department. When I was reviewing this, obviously, my first thought kind of harkened back to the Department of Health and some of their fatality review teams. I know they have an infant mortality review team, and also kind of brought up ideas about the Second Look Commission that looks at DCF cases where there were, you know, multiple interactions with the Department of Children's Services when it came to abuse and neglect. So, the other consideration, I think, with this is the overdose data and obviously cause of death and information related to that is all kind of a function of the Department of Health since they have vital records and things of that nature. So that like some others were saying, that would be a good thing to probably think through more. Where does that belong? Does it belong at mental health and substance abuse services? Does it belong at the Department of Health, who's got the data? Those are some things to think about.
No, that's a great point because health did create the fetal infant death review teams and figured out those guardrails necessary, and the cause of death records are maintained at health department level. So it might be one of those deals that's another one of move it to the commissioner's office to then determine how to proceed, you know, and have the conversation with health about, you know, this has come up on our end. We know it's likely come up on your end. How do we work together to figure that, you know?
So with that being said, Ben, are you making changes to your to what you've proposed?
Well, Debbie, I'm not naive. I think, however it is done, if it were to go in the Department of Mental Health or into the Department of Health, it doesn't matter. There's going to need to be some eventual legislative support to provide the funding necessary. So, but I think if we can get the two commissioners' offices talking about it, then they can figure out how they want to approach the legislature and the governor on taking action at some point.
And I'll ask Zach and Kurt for clarification on my statement. I may be out in left field. What if this went to the commissioner's office with the stipulation that if it's not this year, next year, then it would become a legislative thing in order to help either department support this? Is that appropriate, not appropriate? Kirk's got a frown on his face.
Well, that sort of sounds like a threat, but...
I'm trying to understand what you're proposing, Debbie. I'm easily confused.
Well, okay, so we can go with this as a legislative proposal, and I can take a recommendation. But what I also heard in the discussion was that it may be the two commissioners coming together to decide what is the best way to get the overdose fatality information and give those two departments an opportunity to jointly work this out. Let us know what was worked out, and then next year, if we needed to put it back in order to make a proposal to support their decision to the legislature, that we could. That I might
have. Yeah, no, I understand.
And to confirm, I looked. Sorry, I was going to help. That last year, the proposal that was a full written piece of legislation that I had gotten, and they were proposing originally with Department of Health, but it could be registered with Department of Mental Health. But this was not about any coordination. It was just putting in a new part into the code that would really just talk about that these teams can exist. So these drug overdose fatality and prevention review teams can be established and setting some parameters. So that is one direction you could consider taking with this. But either way, clearly this is something that's coming up in multiple regions, and the health departments feel like this is something that would help prevent overdose deaths. So I think there's obviously a stake among this group in some degree here, but it does seem like if there was going to be any oversight based on the way everything else is done, that the Department of Health would be the ones to probably take that. But yeah, I think a conversation needs to happen one way or another. So maybe I don't know what the best way to do that is.
And Elliot, what I heard you say was that to add to the code that a overdose fatality team could be established. It didn't go any, and just putting it in code. Is that what I heard you say? You're muted, Elliot. Elliot, you're muted.
Thank you. That's essentially the essence. Again, I'm trying to read it very quickly, but where does it say? It says there may be a multidisciplinary and multi-agency drug overdose fatality review team in each county, multi-county area, regional area, or urbanized area. And then they kind of go into some of the parameters. So my understanding is it was to allow some things that they weren't certain they were allowed to do, I think, in terms of either looking at data or talking about things or things like that. They just wanted to make sure, because there was a grant for Davidson County. So Davidson County is doing this, or I believe, I'm not sure if it started or not, but they've been working on this. So it's just they were hoping that we could they could do it safely and not get in any kind of a trouble or have it stopped halfway through. So that's my understanding.
Hey, Elliot, this is Kurt. That generates a question. If there was legislation that didn't pass, but they're doing it now, do we need the legislation to be able to establish these teams, or did Metro Health figure out through their legal that they could proceed without legislation?
I don't want to speak for them, but my understanding is they had a grant, they were proceeding, but they wanted to, in consultation with folks in other states, to shore up the code to make sure that everything was as clean as possible. So I don't know where the pain points are, quite frankly, and I'd be happy to share if it would help the original stuff that they had sent me and we were looking at, if you need it.
No, the original stuff, no.
It wasn't a bill. It was just a proposal that went just between us.
I mean, my guess is, and I don't know, it's, you know, I'm getting in dangerous territory here, but if there was a proposed bill that didn't go anywhere, but now they're doing the program, then there might have been a determination along the way with their legal counsel that legislation is not needed to be able to establish these teams. It's more of a money issue.
I think also they wanted it more, I think, and maybe expand a little bit on what they were doing, so maybe capture some things that they couldn't. I would have to defer to the health departments to provide more information.
Yeah, and I guess their proposal isn't before us here today. So
I didn't submit it on purpose because I asked and they said, no, we're okay.
Okay. So they're not pursuing legislation.
Not in
okay. Debbie, I think your suggestion, I mean, if this committee thinks it's something, that this issue is something that commissioner needs to be aware of, we're always happy to bring it up with her. Don't know where those conversations will go, but be happy to have those conversations for sure.
Thank you. And I will speak, you know, I constantly try to ask, especially here in Davidson County, about the overdose trends and where they're happening and this, that, and the other, because of my navigators and us being assigned to the hospitals here in Davidson County. And I'll tell you, I can't get any information out of them. Now, we did have a first joint conversation of the day, and I think we may be able to work something out and then be able to help me, because I'm trying to figure out how to staff the hospitals to deal with the overdoses. But so far, every time Noelle must be on my mind today, Jessica and I talk about this, I can't get that data. So I do know that even getting specific data out of the Department of Health on that study that they're working on, that grant that they're working on, is extremely difficult. They hold it tight to the chest. So I guess what I need to know at this point, because we've had several discussions, one was to go ahead and move it forward as a legislative issue. Then there was the discussion of I'm trying to read my notes here, talking specifically about overdose fatality review teams to be established to put that in the code, or do we just take it to the commissioner and go from there? So, Ben, I'm going to come back to you as the originator of this, and what is your desire as we move forward?
I'm happy to do the last, take it to the commissioner, say this is on our radar screen, it's been recommended. We also know that Davidson County created one. We know it's also likely something that's arisen at the Health Department's Community Improvement Council level. But now what do we do? And see what her pleasure is in terms of talking to the Department of Health Commissioner and see if we want to put it in their court or work together.
There a motion? Are you making that in a motion, Ben?
Yes, ma'am.
Second.
I'll second it.
Thank you. Any further discussion on this?
Debbie, before this train of conversation, I just wanted to, I posted in the chat the overdose report that the Department of Health does on an annual basis. So just to kind of give us a foundation of what Department of Health is doing now. So hopefully that's helpful, but I just wanted everyone to be able to see that.
Okay, thank you. All in favor signify saying aye, that it goes to the commissioner.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
Thank you. All right, let's see what our next one is here. Region 3, Tennessee Behavioral Health Service Accessibility and Modernization Act. Who is going to be my Region 3?
Well, this is Gail. I will try. I think Nicole's on here as well, so I'm hoping she'll back
me. Region 2? Was that from Region 2?
I think it's Region 2.
Oh, good.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
good. I needed help. Good.
I can't read the numbers here.
Yeah, Gail, I appreciate you jumping in. You were going to do it. I love it. That's awesome.
Yeah, I thought. Yeah, y'all thought you were off the hook and wouldn't have to hear me talk for a while. Okay,
right,
so what this is about, and I'm going to want Mary Nell Osborne to chime in here too. You know, the probably one of the neatest things about the last year and the pandemic has been the tremendous support of the department to its grantee agencies, allowing us all sorts of flexibility to, in the spirit of the scopes of our grants, to find a way to still deliver our services. And those flexibilities included the tremendous migration of the types of work we do to the virtual arena and doing things on Zoom or on Teams or what have you. And of course, you know, clinicians got the extensions that were mandated to allow them to bill for clinical services delivered virtually, that sort of thing, as long as sometime within like 180 days prior their client had been seen face to face, all that stuff. Well, in the clinical world, that's all fine. But in the non-clinical arena, many of the grantees have been enjoying those same flexibilities to deliver services via a virtual platform of some kind. And in fact, their service delivery has been enhanced that way because people that didn't want to ride in the van to get to the peer support center, you know, 3 hours each way or, you know, stuff like that, they now were able to serve them because they could do so virtually. And so it actually increased the numbers of people that they could serve, helped them, the peer support centers be able to reach people that they wouldn't have served previously. And it's become quite valuable tool in their arsenal of resources to serve clients. And so the thing I think that Cheryl was reaching for when she wrote the proposal was, boy, you know, the traditional model of peer support at the peer support centers was people got on the van and got to the brick and mortar building, right? But we now know we don't have to deliver service that way. And boy, wouldn't it be nice to be able to continue delivering service that way as needed and still be able to bill our grant funding agency for that service provided in a virtual manner. So I'm going to now ask Mary Nell if I've stated all of that correctly or if she needs to clean up my ad lib of that.
No, you absolutely have captured it. You know, I was just looking, I keep the numbers on the board, and we have the staff and our serving our four county areas through Peninsula has doubled the contacts. Some of the stories that I get to hear are how members are jumping onto multiple offerings, like if Blount County's group is offering something in Knox, they'll kind of do this accessing whatever their group of interest is. But yesterday I heard a story that kind of summed it up. We've got a fella participating who used to be suicidal and no longer is. We're always glad to hear that. He's on a feeding tube. And if he was not able to access services virtually, it would be a tremendous, I don't even know if he could do it, if he could arrange transportation, and I certainly know it wouldn't be safe for him. there are many like him that have come out, folks with lots of physical challenges as well as psychological, tremendous anxiety, social anxiety, and we're asking them to get on a group van. So that is what we're asking. We're not saying we never want to go pick up people and have a real in-person gathering. They can't wait for that. We just don't think that's the best resource of our time, of our money. And we're not serving people because we're running around driving. So I think you got it.
Good.
I really support this. And this is Ricky. And I want to add to that. Definitely peer support is a great place for this, but training has also been a great opportunity in some of our grants to expand to virtual platforms and have more participants. So I wholeheartedly support and would just add to that that training is another great opportunity for it.
Yeah. Now I would add on top of that, Ricky, you know, we have a large school-based program, and you know, if we weren't able to flex and deliver that program virtually to some schools this year, we'd have been in big trouble. And, you know, we don't know what we might see moving forward. We think our school-based program will go back to normal face-to-face, but you never know if something's going to rear its head again. And so this would allow those opportunities. The other thing is, you know, some of our grantee organizations got really good at delivering community education via webinar, too. And so those organizations probably need to figure out ways to continue that because it's a fantastic way to reach people we wouldn't otherwise reach if we were forced to do something at 6 o'clock at night in downtown Knoxville or something like that. So we could do something by webinar and reach a lot more folks through those training programs too.
All right. And I don't know this, so I'm asking.
It does not require legislation. This could be a decision in central office easily enough.
I guess that was my question. I was wondering, with all the changes that we've seen legislatively around telehealth and telemedicine, is this, and this is a legislative proposal meeting, is this a legislative proposal?
Yeah, Kurt, you know how this is. Right in that legislative proposal document, there's the good question. Is this something that requires legislation or can it be decided by rules? So, you know, as creatures of comfort, we have all figured out this system here. Yes, we can write a legislative proposal, but if that proposal is what gets the attention of the decision makers to be able to decide something by rule, well, this is the way to get it in the door to be considered. Okay. So
what is this? That's
what goes on with a lot of these recommendations. We're just trying to, it can be done by rule, I think, if the commissioner is willing to do so.
It could be done by rule, but I'm asking, does it have to be done by rule? And
how
I guess I'm asking I'm just trying to clarify what is happening. What is not happening now or possible now legislatively or rule that would need to be changed for?
Let's ask Mary Nell. Mary Nell,
okay,
the impetus was, you know, peer support centers were fearful that they'd lose that flexibility.
Yeah, so because we are required to provide transportation as the grant is written, and we're in the second of a 3-year grant year, right? So it is in the grant itself. The language in the grant would need to be changed so to accommodate this change, I believe.
Is the department the funder?
Yeah.
So this is a contract issue.
That's a contract, yes. So we're not talking about anything. I just want to be clear. Are we talking about anything beyond peer support centers that are specifically funded through grants from the Department of Mental Health? Like, are we talking about the centers that are funded by other methods or other services?
Well, I do know on the A&D side, at the end of June, we have to go back to in-person. Virtual is not going to be allowed going forward. And like I've heard conversations here is that we found that to be very beneficial for a lot of people.
It's the end of May, isn't it?
Oh, is it the end of May? Oh, come on. I was just hoping. You're probably right now.
Okay. Are we talking about the executive order?
That was the executive order that she's referencing, yes. Non-licensed.
And I even asked Linda and them on a, I think it was during a TADF meeting, if I'm not mistaken, and Richard can probably correct me, but I used the example, my MAC clients up in Clarksville. After their intensive outpatients, then they come once or twice a week for the duration of being in the MAC program. Well, at this time, many of them have gotten jobs or this, that, and the other. And the flexibility to have ongoing telehealth with them versus forcing them to come to a brick and mortar, we were still hoping for that flexibility to allow telehealth on the substance abuse side. But unless I misunderstood, the answer was no. You could not after, I guess, May or whatever the date is.
It's June. Well,
yep. Go ahead, Mary. Sorry.
I was just going to say that is a the governor's mandate, which is being lifted for non-licensed professionals. So you probably have lots of master's level folks who are not yet licensed running those programs. We're in the same boat for everybody. And for some patient, it would be beneficial if they didn't have to come for a 20-minute, 5-minute meeting. Yeah.
And I
would, thanks, Mac. What's important here?
There was a lot of legislative activity that tried to memorialize a lot of the executive order provisions. One of those was specific to unlicensed providers. I'm going to pull that public chapter real quick. And if y'all will see in the chat, as we have discussions related to certain things, I'm trying to put those links to relevant legislation in the chat so everybody can see those. So this particular bill, it was House Bill 508, now Public Chapter 179. A graduate who has completed or a student actively enrolled in a professional training program, the educational standards of which meet the training requirements for a license under Title 63 or Title 68, as long as the graduate student is providing telehealth services for the purpose of obtaining hours required for licensure or otherwise fulfilling the educational requirements, is at all times supervised by an individual who is licensed under this title or Title 68 with an unencumbered license. So this bill is allowing unlicensed graduate students and other students actively enrolled in a professional training program to provide telehealth services as a result of this public chapter.
Okay, let's go and look at the CPRSs.
Mm-hmm.
They are not licensed. They're certified.
And most don't have.
Are they providing treatment?
They're providing recovery support services, not clinical services.
I would look to, again, we as a department, we can't give the individual providers legal advice. So I would look to the definition of what telemedicine or telehealth is, and then have your legal representative give you an opinion on what opens you up to liability and what would not as far as activities. But to piggyback on what Zach said, there was a lot of things that were in executive orders that people were using that actually got codified. So there's a lot broader way of using telehealth, telemedicine than it was. And there were certain activities that never fell under telemedicine or telehealth in the first place. You didn't need permission to do those virtually. I don't want to get into saying which one of those are. I would look to those. I think the department and TennCare are also, as far as the grants are what we're going to pay for there's a difference between, so there's, and I told Avis I wasn't going to talk on this thing today, and I just listened to me. I'm sorry, Avis. I'm sorry. There's a world, there's a couple of things that the telehealth, telemedicine laws were doing. One was what you can do, and then what insurance or payers have to pay for, right? Those are the kind of what's going on. So at the risk of, to keep from getting into giving legal advice or saying things that I don't want y'all to rely on those things that I say. I want y'all to be able to look at those yourselves. There's a much broader world of what you can do through telemedicine. There were some things that weren't considered telemedicine in the first place. There's a difference between what you can do and what you get paid for. All that to say, I want to get us back on track with discussing Region 2's proposal. And the other thing that's the thing that's expiring in the executive order on May 31st, I believe is 33.1, which I my understanding in the plain language of that is that only has to do with the first CON for inpatient treatment. I could be wrong. And that allows audio only for that first CON. Don't rely on what I'm saying, but take a look at some of those things that have passed in the last couple of months.
All right, I want to go back. Ben, you want to re-summarize for me what you're proposing?
Yeah, I first need to say we've got to make very clear not to contrast apples to oranges, if you will. The legislation that Zach brought to our attention was very important, but that was for non-licensed professionals. And what and Kurt referenced the other legislation. But this proposal is really about making a decision to allow peer support centers under contract with the Department of Mental Health to continue delivering services in a virtual capacity as needed, and then also, of course, have the flexibility by contract scope to deliver services and transportation as needed as well. And so, you know, that's what this is about. It's not really about getting into the weeds of the legislation that's been filed, you know, that extended executive orders and all that stuff. This is about, let's make it so the terrific peer support services we have can continue to enjoy virtual opportunities or platforms to deliver services to those that might not have been served previously.
Is there a second to that?
All right, I can unmute. I second.
Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion?
Yes, I have a question real quick. I'm just trying to make sure I understand. So for the purpose of this, that legislation that was shared is related to health insurance entities, and I'm literally just now pulling up the definition of them. But I'm wondering if the department in the, you know, contracting with providers to deliver mental or behavioral health care services, is any of that covered under the law that pertains to a health insurance entity? Is that something that you guys can provide guidance on?
Not at this time.
Okay.
I think pulling it up and just looking at it right now is probably not a good use of our time to try to
I was just asking if you do.
You're talking about the unlicensed people?
No, not at all. I'm just talking about the rules on telehealth that allow the use of that applied to under the insurance section of Tennessee Code. It's for health insurers. Is how that is there. And so
right.
I'm wondering
right.
in services that are not done through health insurance but are meant for folks who are uninsured or through contracts with the Department of Mental Health, I'm asking if there are rules in place that
would basically the same provisions apply, or that doesn't apply at all when we're talking about department funded services? Does that make sense?
I think, and as you were talking, Elliot, and then I'll call for the vote, is while you, I think in Ben's part, he said the flexibility through the virtual capacity through the contractual support. And what I heard was the health insurance entity was what was covered. What would be the expanding of that to include those funded through the Department of Mental Health Substance Abuse Services contracts? So while it talks about the insurance companies, could it have added those contracts that are done through the department, that this would be applicable to them as well? And that would cover the peer centers. It would cover whatever I want to do through my contracts with the state. So I'd like to add that part if I'm allowed to as chair.
And that actually might make it a real legislative proposal, not a contract concern.
Okay.
Yeah, I support that, Debbie. I think that's a great way to frame it.
So are we talking about essentially defining the services provided under the Department of Mental Health as the same rules applied to a health insurance entity? What are we talking about? I'm just trying to follow the conversation.
Ben, can you go with that?
Yeah, I'm agreeable to your friendly amendment, because what it does is it suggests language to amend the state legislation, PC 179, to allow departmental grantees flexibility to deliver services virtually in the future.
And Marianelle, I think you seconded. Are you okay with seconding the amendment?
I am in approval of the amendment and will support that.
I can't read Kirk's face this morning. He's got this little smirky thing going on that I can't tell if he's sneaky or what's going on in that brain. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed likewise. So this will go as a legislative proposal.
Kirby might have to circle back around you. I'm not completely sure what that legislative proposal is asking for, but we'll get clarification before we present it to Commissioner.
We got all the confidence in the world in you and Zach. All right.
Clean it up.
Moving on to the next is Tennessee Jail Substance Abuse Disorder Treatment Study Project. And that's you, Ben?
You know, Mary Dell's nodding her head. It means she doesn't want to talk about it. This is a recommendation that there be pilot legislation establishing a substance abuse treatment study in 3 county jails, one in each grand division. It does not matter if they are rural jails or urban jails. The need that's been identified is persons with addiction or substance abuse issues get incarcerated and in county jails, mind you. That doesn't matter if they're arrested by the city or the county, or whether they're then placed there by the Tennessee Department of Corrections, because we know many of them get placed that way. But they get incarcerated, and there is not a substance abuse treatment program in county jails, whereas there can be in a Tennessee Department of Corrections prison, there can be substance abuse programs. So is trying to clarify there is a need for this at the county jail level and asking for support to create that pilot program to occur in each of the grand divisions.
This became blatantly evident as the pandemic locked all the jails down. We couldn't figure out how to do virtual, how to do, and there is no treatment, and the recidivism of hate of what folks who are put in jail who have mental health issues and substance abuse issues is huge. The recidivism is just over and over again. So we think that if there was treatment, access to treatment, and then, gee, we could follow them when they're discharged, would really be a benefit to the state, certainly good care and another extension of the department. So.
Discussion. I know there, a couple of years ago, there was a project that was to be done in two rural counties. We were supposed to be one of them, and I think First Step Recovery out of Memphis area was to do the other one. And that was, we were to go into the county jail, and two county jails were identified, that we would provide some treatment in the jail, and we would also supply the Vivitrol injections. God rest her soul, Ellen Abbott talked me into doing a license in a rural county so that when they stepped out of that jail, they could still continue with treatment and do the follow through. Supposedly there was some legislation. It was something that came out of the legislative body. I don't think it was legislation, but it was something. She was doing this because of something going on up at the Hill. We did that, but there kept being roadblocks by the Sheriff's Association, and it never came to fruition. And so, as a result, I'm closing that office. I've had the discussion with the commissioner to make sure she's okay with me closing that office based on needs. But I do know, and it may have been just because of the Vivitrol injections going on in the jail, but the Sheriff's Association got crossways with that subject.
So, Debbie, I may be able to share shed a little bit of light on that. And this may have been before I got here, but I think I kind of understand the background. There have been efforts over the last several years to get appropriations amendments in the budget related to Vivitrol. It's funny, we actually met with the Vivitrol representatives yesterday to do kind of our periodic check-in with them. And If memory serves me correctly, this was a legislative budget amendment that created this pool of funding to be able to provide that services in those settings. And like you said, there have been many years of resistance to MAT programs kind of in general for that population. We're probably seeing a little bit more of a shift on the state level with MAT on the Department of Corrections level. But as you stated, there has been a lot of resistance on the law enforcement side and the corrections community side to MAT in those certain facilities. So just something to keep in mind. And like you said, it didn't come to fruition because there wasn't really any adopters to do that, unfortunately.
Well, and I'm gonna take my legislative hat off, and I'm gonna go back here as a treatment provider in the field. Okay. And having been a jail administrator prior to getting into the field. I guess I have, I'm the person
who would
have a little bit of issues with this as a treatment provider. So I'll put that hat on and I'll take it back off and go back over here. Sometimes it's hard wearing different hats. But I do know in the other rural county that Ellen talked me into putting a license office. She did do a program change. The department has the community the jail liaisons. I forgot what they're called. Where they go in the jail and they work. All right. I do know that there was something put out to copy what Judge Sloan was doing over in East Tennessee with Ten Rocks. And I know that that got done in, I forgot the judicial district that includes Williamson, Hickman, Lawrence, and Perry County, whatever that judicial district is. So that person became a Ten Rock person. And that person's responsibility was to get the beds as soon as they left the jail to get them into treatment services. So I do know that, and I know what are those liaisons? Criminal justice liaisons, that's what they're called, are in the jails. So are we saying that's not working?
I don't think they're the treatment providers in the jails. I think this is something separate. They're meant to help link people to treatment after they leave jail, is my understanding.
No, I agree with that. I agree with that, Elliot. But is that process not working from getting Kurt out of jail into treatment with Ben?
I'm not sure that's relevant here, though. I hear what you're saying, and I think that would be good to look at. But regarding this proposal, this is, if I'm reading it right, it's talking about treatment in jails, and it specifically mentions the idea that there are state prisoners, and there are a lot more of them more recently, who are in local jails for extended periods of time and wanting to offer, you know, some sort of standardized treatment program or, you know, evidence-based treatment program for those individuals. So I don't know that it's really, the two are related.
All right. You mentioned specifically state prisoners. What about the little local people that are in jail all the time?
That's one. I'm just mentioning, I didn't write this proposal. I just mentioned, they mentioned that as a population of focus. My concern with going with local prisoners is I like the idea, but I would just want to make sure there's guardrails to make sure this could never be used to keep someone in jail longer than they were supposed to be there, or to put them in jail because that's the only way they can access treatment.
Oh, of course.
Any further discussion?
I mean, the idea is good, but how do we do this? I don't know the right way to go about it. I think we need more mental health and substance use disorder treatment another meeting right before this about this issue of what we, you know, what we're missing in jails and prisons, but in jail. So I don't know if this is the right way to go about it or not, but it sounds like there needs to be some conversations and thought on this. And I like the idea.
I had to step out. This is Richard over in Jackson. I had to step out a minute. Y'all might have already talked about this. If we're going to provide therapeutic services in jail, does that jail have to be licensed by the department?
Now, if I'm not mistaken, and I go back and pull up a long history here, there was always the exception that a sheriff's office did not have to be licensed. Am I correct there still, Kurt or Zach?
Debbie, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head. I'm sorry. Not prepared to answer that.
I think the way around that would be if there were licensed providers running the program so that the facility didn't have to hold the license.
And so they're doing meds in these places anyway. So, I mean, they're delivering some sort of behavioral health care. So it's a great question, Richard. And I think I don't know the answer, but it sounds like that. I'm not as concerned about that, but because they're able to do these. And I know in our prisons, they have programs for mental health and substance use disorder to at least some extent.
Right.
Okay.
This is Albert. Debbie, can you hear me?
I can, Albert.
They're not required to be licensed by the state. I mean,
I didn't think so.
No, they're not.
And I'm going to put my other hat back on. I got a problem. If I have to pay over $10,000 in licensure fees, then by gosh, that sheriff's office needs to pay the same licensure fees and meet the same requirements that I have to meet. They're not that special, and I've worked in a jail, so I can say that.
Debbie, I suggest let's look at a legislative proposal for next year that touches on some of this stuff. I'm seeing a bit of a double standard in some other pots of money where there's strings attached for behavioral health providers or agencies that are not for law enforcement, and I just think everybody needs a fair shot at this, and if people are delivering behavioral health care in the state, we want it to be done the right way, and I don't think people should be able to do it outside of the normal rules. So certainly worth a look and conversation.
But this is Albert again. If I could just throw 2 cents in, the Department of Corrections has its own budget. And so, you know, they determine where their dollars go to and for what usage, much like mental health department does and substance abuse. So, you know, you're talking about two different departments who have the right to set what rules they have related to what services they're providing and what requirements are needed. And so they're not required to have a license in the prison. I know that firsthand because we have a contract with the Department of Corrections, and secondhand because I was on a licensure for a while. So healthcare. So I know that that's not a requirement. I do understand the reason why, because they're two separate entities.
Can I make a suggestion for this proposal?
Yeah, please.
Some more research and conversation happen and be reconsidered for next year?
Ben?
Mm-hmm.
Region 2, are you in agreement with more research?
I'm okay with that. We can send it back to the author of the proposal to do that.
That'd be acceptable.
We bear it down?
Yes, we can.
Motion that it be sent back to the originating author for further consideration.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. All right. Next one, Behavioral Health Preparedness Study Commission.
Yes, and I'm going to tell you right now, I am the author of this one.
Not to pick on you too bad.
You know, we've heard lots of different ways about the behavioral health workforce problems that we have. I'm sorry, you broke up.
No,
it's yours.
Okay. Yeah, it's from Region 2. So we've heard lots about behavioral health workforce issues and shortages and stuff like that. The purpose of this proposal is really to draw attention to looking at this from the great big picture. There are some low-lying fruit here that the department has already started to address. I know the department's created a task force. They're going to meet some this summer that's going to zero in and focus just on the provider rates through 10 care. That's kind of low-lying but important fruit to go after. But the workforce problem is much deeper than that, and there's some elephants in the room, if you will. The mid-level and higher-level fruit is what what number of professionals do we need in the behavioral health service delivery system 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 15 years from now? Now, I got a lot of gray hair. I don't plan on being here in 15 years, but most of the people on this screen, they're still going to be here in 10 years. And we just can't keep saying, you know, this is a issue, and then we don't work towards the long-term solutions too. And so we need to really, I think, have departmental, and it's not just the Department of Mental Health, but it's other departments and the legislature, really study the whole breadth of the problem, because this is really going to require a lot of moving parts of various departments moving forward to harvest all the low-lying stuff that we can do, and then start to fill in and be able to attack the mid-range and longer-term issues. And those issues are like the mental health pipeline, you know, from start to someone goes to college and wants to become a therapist or a doctor or a nurse. Well, when we get them motivated to enter that pipeline, to exiting the pipeline and being placed in a field placement and then hired, or keeping them in the field and not leaving public sector in that revolving door to exit and go work in the private sector because they could choose who the hell they want to work with, right? And so, I mean, there's all sorts of issues there that connect. And what is the most scary thing to me in my job is having conversations with CEOs of provider entities. And I keep asking the question, and I'm getting crickets on the answer. How many licensed professionals do you need in 5 years? How many do you need in 10 years at your agency? How many do you need in 15 years in your agency? And those are the things that if we're going to, as a planning council and stakeholders, address the behavioral health workforce needs of our state to be able to meet the demands of Tennesseans who need to access services, those are the things that keep me up at night and losing sleep. Yeah, it's scary, Debbie, to hear professionals say they don't know how many they're going to need in 5 years. And so that's an issue, and I'm concerned about those things, and that's why this proposal is there, so we can have a lot deeper, broader study to discuss the breadth of our problem and figure out what the low-lying fruit is, the mid-range, and the higher level that we can work towards.
Kurt?
Yeah, thanks, Debbie. And Ben, thanks for bringing up this issue. It's one that was reflected throughout the needs assessment and is one that the department is paying attention to and taking action on. And you referenced the task force. We're calling it a work group, but same thing. And it's not just the department that's putting that on to address a very salient point you made. This is not something that just we can solve. But the TennCare has also joined in on this work group with us. I think that's important to make sure that people know that they are a co-host of this work group. And it's not going to be just limited to rate reimbursement discussions. It is going to be, like you said, Ben, a macro look at the public mental health system and how this is how this issue is impacting it and how it could impact. I've looked at, our Office of Research is getting ready to kind of set the table for the participants in the work group so that they have a good idea of what's going on. And something that you just mentioned, you know, there's good information out there that says, you know, in 10 years time, 20 years time, here's going to be the deficits for each state. And in each, these are projections, but each state for each, kind of scope of practice or healthcare provider position. So we're going to be looking into those kind of things. And
right.
The department. I'm sorry, Ben. You go ahead.
There are two things that we got to get out there. There are two things that have to get out there in this conversation so everyone can understand it. Access to healthcare is the worst piece of data around, okay? Because access is determined by the number of residents per healthcare professional. And so the 90th percentile of behavioral health access to care is 270 residents per licensed mental health professional in a state. Tennessee right now is at 630 residents per licensed mental health professional. And so that means we're not where we should be. Now, if you want to dissect that ratio a little bit, that ratio is only looking at the number of licenses that are active and maintained under the Department of Health's licensure, okay? It does not clarify how many of those licenses are working in the public sector at a community mental health center or hospital or state hospital, and it doesn't identify how many of those 600 or those licenses are working in the private sector, not serving the people we care about. And so the access ratio is something we are going to have to understand and dig deep to understand to know how deep our problem is. So that's the first elephant in the room. The second elephant is this one. I love the fact that we created that mental health trust fund, but I'm scared to death of it, and I'll tell you why. If the schools start to get that money, they're going to create school social workers, and then where are they going to get them? They're going to steal them from our service providers, right? They're not all going to get them straight out of a graduate school program. And so that's going to further create a problem. So we've got to understand the full breadth and know that everything needs to be studied and understood so we can figure out what our action steps are. And we've got to make sure that the task force that starts this summer really does focus on the whole thing, not just rates, because the messaging right now has been focused solely on rates, Kurt. So
if I can, I want – thank you, Ben. Thank you. I want to look because Region 4 has a very similar workforce proposal. And so
– I'm sorry.
Ben, if you don't mind, I want to table yours for a minute. I want to see what Region 4 is and see if there's similarities and common grounds that we could go use on. So, Elliot, you want to take this one?
Sure, absolutely. And I don't have anything to hide here. Ben and I have talked this whole time. Ben and I are very active and collaborate with many other people. This was very intentional that we have multiple of these. This is Ben and I talked with lots of the regions. We in our own regions work to elevate. This is an issue. I talked to Kurt. He said the best way to get proposals put forward to elevate things in the needs assessment. So we did that, and we put forward some workforce proposals. Last year, we put forward a proposal on workforce to talk with the Department of Health about adding survey questions at relicensure. And those conversations started but have not actually developed because of COVID-19, per my understanding. So we're trying, and I know the Department of Mental Health is doing as much as they can to try to help us address this issue. And this goes well beyond a single department, for sure. The proposal that I put forward from Region 4 was about a work group to specifically focus on workforce development that is based within the Planning and Policy Council. This is actually before a decision was made, but I'm just going to share. I wrote a paper for TAMHO. I've studied this issue as much as anyone in the state, I believe, and I requested to be in the work group, but, you know, that was not accommodated, which is okay, and things happen. But if this is truly a macro work group the state is going to host, and it should be open to our experts from the Planning and Policy Council and other points of view beyond the standard provided, you know, the big associations and such. So, again,
hey, Elliot, can I address that?
Go ahead.
Ben Parker and Albert King will be invited to participate in the work group to be the representative for the state wide and regional council. So we absolutely agree with your point on that.
I understand. But my point is the people who want to be in the room to talk about this and help, who have expertise, may not be in those rooms. And I think we need to look at this from every angle. Again, this is not about bitterness. This is written before any of that. This is just a matter of, hey, I know how politics work, how things go, and there's some other things here. But we need to move this forward in one way or another and make sure that we address the workforce. The data is tied up with the Department of Health for the providers, so it's really, really difficult to get this. And their efforts, they're not specifically looking at all these mental health providers. So we do need to get everybody together and talk about this. So I fully support Ben's proposal for a formal study commission. I also think that we should have our own work group where those of us with all sorts of on the ground or talking with people in all different sectors and around the country can talk with each other and present ideas, not to make any policy changes, but to make recommendations specifically on an issue that impacts just about every need that we present year in, year out.
Okay. I'm trying to, Elliot, if you would, please go back for me and summarize what it is you're requesting here. What I heard was a workforce group that focuses strictly on workforce issues and that be a part of a group of the planning council.
I'll just read the, it's brief. I'll read the, I wrote out the actual legislation and the changes. So under the planning section of the Planning Policy Council, it would just be added, departments shall convene and facilitate a statewide
workforce. That is the light part in your proposal.
On page one in the lighter text, that is what I'm reading.
33-2-204.
Correct. Yes. So I'll finish.
That is what you're proposing. Okay.
I'll finish reading that if you allow me, so everybody understands. Facilitate a statewide work group within the State Mental Health Planning and Policy Council to examine workforce and make recommendations annually to the Commissioner, Governor, and General Assembly. This work group shall include experts representing all seven planning regions and shall be open to any interested member of the regional or state mental health planning and policy councils. The work group shall be convened no later than September 1st, 2022, and a report with policy recommendations related to maintaining and growing the behavioral health workforce shall be submitted to the Commissioner, Governor, and General Assembly annually. First report due January 30th, 2023. Meeting a minimum of two times per year. And I put in some ability for there to be some requests from the Department of Mental Health for funding to help facilitate this work group, because I know that staff time is valuable. And in past work groups, that has been a challenge. So I wanted to make sure that everybody had an opportunity. So we need, I guess Ben and I's point, if I could speak for Ben, is this is something we have to be addressing on a longer term scale. We have to make sure that we're addressing this, not just right now, but next year and every year going forward. And while we totally appreciate what's going on in the work of the Department of Mental Health and 10 Care to work on putting a work group together, there is no guarantee of any kind right now that that will continue past this year. And we want to ensure that it will.
All right. So we got this one.
Clarifying question.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, this is Ricky. Can I ask a clarifying question? So as I understand the discussion, there's already an intention or an existing work group being put together through the department that includes the executive members of the Planning and Policy Council. Is that correct?
Hey, Ricky. The Kim and Albert will be part of the work group that we put together in collaboration with 10 Care. Other members of that will be professional organizations. I think we're bringing in some schools to talk about some of the things that Ben talked about, the pipeline, the future forward type of look of how we keep people in this field, not just limited to rates.
Right.
So yeah, there is going to be statewide council executive presence as a member of the work group. And actually, we are planning on talking with Kim and Albert right after this meeting, but it's okay to bring up right now. It is pertinent. But on June 8th, we're planning on having some time during the June 8th planning and policy meeting for Kim and Albert to lead a discussion to hear from the members of the statewide committee, which include regional council chairs and vice chairs, about the issues that they think are important around workforce development. So I hope that we're trying to be as open and transparent and collaborative as possible, understand Ben and Elliot's proposals, and we'll leave that to this committee to decide how y'all want to approach it. But I hope that answers your question.
So my quick question first in front of this group.
Clarification. I was just going to add, but you said it for me, that, you know, I certainly trust that Kim and Albert would take any feedback from, you know, any of us that we would provide to the group. So I would personally feel comfortable in that scenario. So thanks for that clarification.
Also, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I just want to ask a question before piggybacking off what Kurt said. You know, in the line of open and transparent communication, I asked a question by email. I'll ask it right now. So are those work group meetings open to public observing?
That's something that we're talking over with our general counsel's office, Elliot. And we'll have an answer back to you as soon as we've talked with them.
Okay. I just wanted to ask that clarification. Thanks.
All right. So I want to go back to do these two real quick. We're at 11:30, but we have two other quick policies. Ben, I know you kept referencing mental health. I'd like for that workforce to make sure you also included substance abuse professionals.
Yes.
In those discussions.
Yes. Behavioral health is fine.
Behavioral. All right. So so we have two proposals that are working toward workforce. One is a study commission. Is this a legislative issue?
It is in my opinion, Debbie, okay. And here's the deal. All of these workforce issues at some point are going to require some ownership, and it just can't be the department's owning it being the champion of the idea. You're going to need legislative support to own some of these things that will be determined as essential moving forward.
Is there a second to this proposal of behavioral health preparedness study commission?
Second. I second.
Okay, thank you. Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye. Opposed likewise.
Aye.
We also have from Region 4, the Behavioral Health Workforce Development Work Group. That's a lot of words. And I'm assuming because it is referenced by adding to Title 33, this is a legislative proposal as well. Is there a motion to accept it as it has been presented?
And can I ask a follow-up question, Debbie? Is there any appetite in trying to combine the two together?
That's a good point, Zach. Thank you. Would Region 4?
I would be willing to accept that if Elliot would.
Certainly, if we can make both ask and one, sure.
All right, I'm going to ask you to do this if you don't care, gentlemen. Since y'all been working together anyway, can you come together with me with one proposal?
Yes.
And then I would ask this group, when they jointly come together combining the two proposals on this motion, would you agree to accept what they're going to present by combining this? I'll take a motion.
I so move.
Second. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed likewise. All right, the next one, and I've already talked to Kirby, and she told me just to keep going. Region 4, Fentanyl Overdose Prevention Act. Elliot?
Okay, this might be something that's not everybody's familiar with, and I hope that this group has been able to read the proposals, although I know they just were distributed yesterday. Fentanyl is killing people at a higher rate than any other drug in our state. 500% increase in fentanyl overdose deaths from 2014 to 2019. It's very straightforward that this is the most dangerous substance we are dealing with right now, and its analogs. The federal government earlier this year announced that they would allow for federal grant funds to be used for the purchase of fentanyl tests. Oh, sorry, fentanyl.
Say it again.
Okay, sorry. The federal government announced a rule change that allows the federal grant dollars to be used for the purchase of fentanyl test strips. Fentanyl test strips are inexpensive, about a dollar a piece. They're like little pieces of paper that have some lines and things on them that you literally, let's say you have a bag that has residue from drugs. It could be cocaine. It could be pills. It could be anything. And you put a little water in it. You put the little piece, the test strip in it, you wait about 1 to 2 minutes and it will tell you one line, yes, it contains fentanyl, two lines, no, it does not appear to contain fentanyl. And these things are highly accurate, like over 98%. And the good company that offers it, you can even detect these more dangerous analogs, at least some of them. So it's one of those things that research has shown very clearly to be helpful in when people use test strips before they were to consume drugs. There's a higher likelihood that they will have someone there with them to support and make sure they're safe. They might have Narcan that they otherwise would not have had there. They'll reduce their dose, and some people won't use at all or discard their drugs. So what this is doing is a harm reduction tech method that is used in much of the rest of the country. It's even been used here in Tennessee in the past. My understanding is that I think, I'm not sure, funded through the Department of Mental Health or organized, but there were overdose prevention boxes put together through TADIS and distributed to various anti-drug coalitions. And those boxes used to contain fentanyl test strips until mid about 2014, 2015, when I believe someone discovered that, oh, wait, this is against the law. Currently, anything used for testing and analysis of a controlled substance is illegal and punishable by a misdemeanor for possession and a felony for distribution. So right now, that is a big problem. So we have a widely known, respected method for preventing overdose deaths that is being used almost everywhere else in the country. The federal government has said, please use grant money to buy those. And we can't really do that here because it's illegal. So what this proposal does is exempt testing equipment specifically that would include things like this test strip. It's not just about fentanyl, because the next drug, like whether it's ISO or something else, these other things are popping up that we need the ability to test for if there's equipment for or to help people with. So this is not to help in any way protect drug dealers at all. This is squarely on people who would be using a substance. And one of the biggest problems here is counterfeit prescription drugs, where people who are not tolerant to opioids take a Xanax or take what they think is a Xanax or use some cocaine or some ecstasy or whatever, you name the substance, and it turns out to be counterfeit, pressed, made, cut with something that is fentanyl or fentanyl related, and they die. And this is happening all over the state and all over the country. So this is one way of helping to prevent that.
Discussion. Motion.
Debbie, I'm sorry. Can I ask a question?
You may. Who is this?
This is Zach again.
Zach, okay.
Wanted to check it just because these typically, and I'm thinking in the same context as like a needle exchange program, other harm reduction type programs, is there any appetite for potentially trying to limit it to And I know the rationale for not limiting it to fentanyl, but I think that if we have the opportunity to use data and the ability to show the actual effect of it now, that if we made it specific to fentanyl, that we might have a better appetite and opportunity at the legislature to potentially pass a piece of legislation like this. So I didn't know if there was an appetite to potentially look at doing that, or if that would be counter to the proposal.
That would be counter at the start of the proposal. But what I'll tell you, unless there's just no way it's going to move and you have inside information to share on that. But what I'll say is I met with Anna Stein from your counterpart in North Carolina, who led the charge to get this law passed there. And she worked with all law enforcement in a very Republican state, as you know, similar to ours in a way. And all branches of law enforcement there were fully supportive of this. Their main concern was about making sure there was no protections for drug dealers. So we already kept that language as is, so that it was very clear that's not what we're doing. And if we have to amend it to just be fentanyl test strips, we can. That would be an unwise policy decision. But it would be better than not having this at all. And I certainly do not want to limit this to the syringe exchange sites. That would be that would not help us.
Oh, certainly not. That was not my suggestion. I just
making sure.
I was looking at that. There was a bill related to the needle exchange and the amount of distance between certain other areas and where it could be located. And I knew, just like I think anyone would expect, there is enough controversy about those that it does pique the interest of legislators. So, it was just a thought and a consideration at looking at something that we know is real, something that we have data to back up.
Well, I appreciate that, Zach. And the proposal, I think, uses that data and backs it up very well and specifically discusses fentanyl. And I think the best approach would be to present this proposal. And then if there is dissent and we feel like it will not move forward and someone says, can you limit it, then we can work with them on that. Does that make sense?
Sure.
I'll entertain a motion to move this forward as the legislative proposal.
So moved.
Second?
Yeah, I'll second if I can do my own proposal.
Any further discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All right, and I think this one is Region 4, the Leading by Example to Reduce Stigma Act.
Absolutely. This is familiar to this group for those who were here last year, so I will try not to take much time on it. This is the virtually the same proposal from last year with some additional evidence and research that has come out since that time. There's been even more of a push at federal levels and by professional groups and association to ask government entities to change names that include or anything that uses the term substance abuse. And we're seeing most other states follow suit. So Tennessee is only one of a few states that actually uses terms that research has shown to directly impact stigma and result in people. Here's the three outcomes from using a term systemically like substance abuse for specifically. One, it reduces the likelihood that someone will access services. So that is certainly not something we want. Two, it increases negative attitudes from clinicians to the people they serve. And three, it reduces outcomes from the care that people get. This has been proven in multiple research studies. It's amazing how powerful language can be. And substance abuse is certainly not the only term, but it is one that I know is commonly used in a lot of areas, but it is something that at most around the country and states and organizations have been working as hard as they can to start shifting to more person-centered language, more clinically appropriate. So substance use or substance use disorder is typically used instead, or addiction. In this case, we did not really want to propose a whole name that's brand new and opens a can of worms for the department. It was just a simple change the word abuse to use. If the department were to be interested in, as a part of this, looking at a completely different name or getting input from folks as they're doing it, we would certainly be open to that. We submitted this to the, this group voted to send this to the commissioner last year. We did that. The commissioner responded, and my understanding of the response was not great timing. I submit this next year. Submit it again next year. So that's what we're doing.
Any further discussion?
Yeah, Debbie, this is Ben. I think it's important that we look at what neighboring states are doing, and if other states are changing their language, then that means it might be time to change things to advance our cause a little bit.
Elliot, out of curiosity, you said one of few states. What are those other states that have not made that change yet?
I'm trying to go through my proposal. One moment.
All right.
So let's see. I wrote it down in another context. I do not believe I listed those, but I looked up. So this is a little complicated, but I looked up at the National Association of State Mental Health, or the people like Commissioner Williams' association. You know,
that's best.
Exactly. And I looked, and there were only five states, including Tennessee, in their directory that had the term substance use or anything abuse or anything like this in there. There were a couple states listed still in there incorrectly with titles that included that, so that inflate the number. But you can see those states were included below in the end of the proposal, where you can see they've actually changed some of those. They just maybe didn't update it on that website. So as far as I can tell, now I did not go to every website for every state department, but I could only find five total. And we've seen many states, as you can see at the end of the proposal, I believe it's on pages 9 and 10, where you can start seeing we've got, you know, Maine and North Dakota, Wisconsin, Maryland, Missouri. I mean, so we're not just talking about, you know, these more democratic progressive states. There's all sorts of folks that are looking at this. And some you can see I provided comments. They specifically did it for the exact reason we're suggesting.
All right. Any other discussion? A motion?
I'll make a motion.
I'll make that motion.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Ben. Second?
Richard, I'll second.
Thank you. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Likewise. All right. Now, I have written notes all over all these proposals. So I'm going to try, and Avis and Kirby will keep me straight, I think. Well, they try anyway. All right. So the first one we had, regarding the JIT strip, that we're just going to send to the commissioner to have her to check with the attorney general to see what's going on there. Correct? If I get it wrong, tell me.
Yes.
All right. The second one,
yes.
The annual behavioral needs assessment, we're going to, that was decided that was a policy decision. And we would send that to commissioner and to look at changing the 2 and 2 to allow the regional councils to increase the number of needs assessments to no more than 6, with an amendment that said also to prioritize those as we sent those in. Is that a correct?
Yes.
Summary? Yes. All right. The third one, the overdose response, I'm trying to look at my notes. Take to the commissioner to at least put it on her radar. And the fact that Metro already has a grant to do this, but to look at what can happen next. The next one was the behavioral health service accessibility and modernization. I got to read my notes here. Oh, this was the one about allowing the flexibility to meet the health insurance requirements, to expand that to all. No, Ben, I see his head going.
To amend that law to allow the grant recipients to deliver services virtually.
Yeah, to expand it to the department's contracts under the Department of Mental Health. Okay.
Yes.
And that is a legislative proposal.
Yes.
Okay. Then I have the jail one, jail use disorder. This was going to go back to the original authors to look at some additional research and go from there. Is that a correct statement? Then the next two dealt with the behavioral
yes.
health preparedness and the workforce development. It was agreed upon that these two could be merged, and taking it back to Ben and to Elliot to do that with our approval to move forward with legislation on that issue. Is that correct? Ben froze on me there.
Yes. Correct. We're going to combine it, and this group has approved it. We're not going to change any language other than combining it into two needs.
All right. Then the fentanyl overdose, this being a legislative action that would look at exempting the testing strips from fentanyl from prosecution and being able to use federal dollars to purchase these inexpensive test strips.
It's just a lot decriminalized. It's basically exempting the test strips testing equipment used for the exact purposes only to reduce overdose deaths and overdoses that would be exempted from the drug paraphernalia law. That's really what this is. So it's to decriminalize the use of test strips to be used in that manner. And just to clarify, if Zach is still on, I just wanted to say that if transmitting this, or if the commissioner wants to send this on to the governor, there needs to be a change made, or you feel like it may not happen, just give me a call. We can discuss.
All right. And then the last one was the legislative, and that is to take the word abuse out of the department's name and substitute use. So did I get all that right? All right. Woo! All righty. Thank you guys for hanging in here with us. I will get with Avis and Kirby and clean up my notes. Kirby, any additional information and instructions from you?
Debbie, I have a couple.
Zach?
And yeah, it is. And I apologize. This is me being the bearer of bad news.
You can go away then.
Oh, sorry. We have the earliest deadline we have ever had for submitting legislative proposals this year. Unfortunately, that's something that's beyond the department's control and unfortunately is not something that I have any ability to give.
What's the date, Zach?
I have to meet with Commissioner next week and have these finalized for submission on Monday, the 7th. And so that's going to require, probably by Monday at the latest, having any of the proposals that have been changed or combined, back to us. And I would say by Monday close of business so we can quickly turn around and meet with Commissioner to get approval on the ones that she wants to submit to the governor's office. So, like I said, I apologize for this. I wish the deadline was more aligned with what we've normally had, but we have been given very strict instructions that that's the due date and nothing will be accepted beyond that due date. So,
And Elliot, when do you think you could have us that combined one?
I'm going to do it right after this, I hope, and get it done with. And I will chat with Ben in a moment. So hopefully it'll be in today. I'm more concerned about that other one from Region 2 that requires some significant revision.
No, Ben,
you froze.
No, he's not.
I couldn't hear him.
Yeah, it's not going to turn around.
The best I could do is we work on it tomorrow.
Which one is
best I could do is work on it tomorrow.
That's the one where you wanted the the accessibility and modernization.
Combining the work one.
That Ben, I got that one. I'll take care of that and just make sure you're good with it. I was talking about yours, the one where I believe the group decided to. Debbie, you asked about adding IOP and other services to the conversation about being allowed to do televideo or telehealth instead of in person for some of these services that are contracted through the department. And I was trying to suggest if that's what the group wanted, that you could just, the law change would be to apply those health insurance entities regulations to department contracted clinical services or whatever you want to call it. I don't know how to do that though, but I'm just trying to help. That was my concern with you guys getting that turned around and rewritten by Monday.
Ben, I'll talk with you afterwards on that, okay?
He's frozen.
I don't know where he's at, but okay. All right. Any other bad news, Zach?
Fortunately, that's all the bad news I have.
Well, okay. We'll let you live then.
Thank you.
Any other... Yes, Avis or,
Hey.
Yes.
Yeah, Debbie, this is Avis. So, the only thing in addition to that, and, that's first and foremost because Zach has a, concrete firm deadline, but in addition to that, same process we use, with you, doing a, letter or memo to executive committee and getting that we'll get that to the committee and Kim for the purpose of the recommendation from the Planning and Budget Committee regarding the legislative proposals, and then that information will be shared at the June PPC meeting as well. That's all I had to add.
Kirby, anything else from you?
Nope.
Is it Monday a holiday for everyone? So how's this all going to be due on Monday at close of business?
Okay. How about Tuesday at close of business, Ben?
Or
that's better.
Yeah. I will certainly do my best to make that work.
Well, Zach, you've got to have everything by the 7th. And next Tuesday won't be the 7th. It'll just be the 1st.
Well, we still have to have our meeting with Commissioner to present these proposals and our internal proposals to her to determine which ones move forward to the governor's office. So I need to try to have that meeting with her on Wednesday. And that gives basically 2 days for me to get these drafted by legal and make sure that all the forms are good to go before submitting them to the governor's office on Monday.
All right. So
Tuesday close of business, we will make that work.
Well, hopefully could you possibly try to have the as early of a meeting as possible on those that are ready and then a shorter meeting on the others? Just a suggestion.
I think it can be all worked out. I'll get with Ben. If you'll get that other one, then I'll get with Ben on the wording on that other one and we'll get it situated.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And Debbie, just so you know, I'm on major grant deadline today. It's due by 5 today. So
I won't bother you today. How about tomorrow we talk?
Morning.
Ben, is it okay if I go ahead and combine and submit those and copy you? And if you have a problem, you can just say so.
Love it.
Great.
Thank you.
As long as they don't have to do it today. All right. I thank everyone, and appreciate your participation. And I'll entertain a motion to adjourn this legislative committee meeting.
I so move.
Second.
Second.
And my usual statement is you vote with your feet, but in this case, you vote with the button to click off the meeting. Bye, guys.
Thank you, Debbie. Thanks, everyone. Bye.